From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
There's not a single country in the world that favors the huge bombardment that is now being planned in Washington.
Except Britain. Today, dissident MP Tony Benn on the British Prime Minister's visit to Washington. Then a conversation with Mexico's leading journalist and author, Elena Poniatowska. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With the American military presence growing in the Gulf, the Iraqi government today sought to prepare a people suffering under UN sanctions and worried about an attack for the possibility of another fight with the United States. Envoys from Russia and the Palestinian Authority, meanwhile, remained in Baghdad another day to press Iraq to compromise on UN demands to inspect so-called sensitive sites, including President Saddam Hussein's palaces, to avert a military strike. The United States and Britain, despite opposition from Russia, France and China, and clear unease among Arab allies, have pressed ahead with their threat to attack Iraq if it does not provide unfettered access to UN weapons inspectors working in the country. As part of the military buildup, the USS Independence arrived in the Gulf on Thursday with a submarine and four other ships. It joined two other U.S. and one British aircraft carrier. President Clinton, meanwhile, ordered ships carrying 2,000 Marines into the region to join the 24,000 American forces. The New York Times reports that Clinton's secretary, Betty Curry, has told prosecutors the president tried to get her to agree that he and young intern Monica Lewinsky were never alone and that he resisted Lewinsky's sexual advances. The paper quotes lawyers familiar with both Curry's account of events and the deposition Clinton himself gave in the Paula Jones sexual harassment suit against him. The Times says Curry ended up telling prosecutors that Clinton and Lewinsky were alone together. It also says the president's secretary has turned over to investigators several gifts she got back from Lewinsky after they had been given to her by the president, among them a hat pin, a brooch, and a dress. The White House press office has issued a statement suggesting that the Times story is based on false leaks. The Justice Department is warning abortion clinics to be on the alert. The government confirms it's told clinics to watch out for such common gifts as potted plants, boxed candy, and stuffed animals that could hide explosives. The warning follows last week's fatal bombing of a clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. A security guard was killed and a clinic worker critically injured. There have been no arrests, and federal agents are looking for a man believed to be a witness. Meanwhile, Birmingham police are also warning gay bars and gay-related service agencies to take precautions. Authorities this week received a letter claiming the bombing was carried out by a group called the Army of God, the same group that said it carried out last year's bombings of an abortion clinic and gay nightclub in Atlanta. And today, supporters of incarcerated Native American leader Leonard Peltier will hold rallies at 32 cities internationally, including Kansas. Spokesperson for the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee.
At Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Leavenworth, Kansas, we are having the International Day to resist the imprisonment of Leonard Peltier at Leonard Peltier's request. He has been incarcerated 22 years and does not want to be forgotten by the people.
Leonard Peltier is a Native American who's been imprisoned since February 6, 1976, for the 1975 shootout between the FBI and the American Indian Movement, in which two federal agents and an Indian man were killed. 4 years after his incarceration, a Freedom of Information Act suit released documents which support Leonard Peltier's innocence and FBI's use of their infamous COINTELPRO program in their efforts to, quote, neutralize members of the movement. Astra USA, the American subsidiary of a Swedish pharmaceutical company, agreed yesterday to pay nearly $9.85 million to former employees who claimed they were sexually harassed. It was the biggest such settlement ever obtained by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. At least 79 women and one man who said he was punished for speaking out against the way women were treated will share in the settlement. Astra USA admitted it allowed a hostile working environment, including requests for sexual favors, in exchange for favorable treatment on the job for female employees. Former President Ronald Reagan turns 87 years old today, and his birthday hasn't gone unnoticed in Washington. Members of Congress have voted to rename National Airport in his honor. President Clinton is expected to sign the bill changing its name to the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. But air traffic controllers, who are still stinging from Reagan's union-busting order to dismiss thousands of their number in 1981, are protesting. Randy Schwitz, executive vice president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, says, "I'd rather have a hot poker in my eye. The wound was created 17 years ago when he fired 11,000 controllers. It's like dumping salt on that wound." You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The threat of force is there, and it is real. These words from British Prime Minister Tony Blair in a warning to Saddam Hussein. Blair made his comments yesterday at the White House, where he and his wife were welcomed by President Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton. Blair said everyone wants a diplomatic solution to the standoff over inspections, but he said the success or failure of diplomacy rests on Saddam. British Prime Minister Tony Blair arrived last evening in Washington, with China and France joining Russia in calling for diplomatic solutions to the Iraq crisis. Britain has been the U.S.'s staunchest supporter in the push for military action. We're now joined by Tony Benn. He is a British parliamentarian with the Labour Party, longest-serving parliamentarian in Britain from Labour. He's joining us from London. Mr. Benn, what is your reaction to your party's position, your prime minister's position on Iraq?
It's the only supporter of the U.S. attack in Iraq. There's not a single country in the world that favors the huge bombardment that is now being planned in Washington. And I'm totally opposed to it. I think it will have very serious consequences, not least in terms of loss of life. And it's something that may be convenient to the president for other reasons, and the British Prime Minister may find it attractive to be seen on the world stage with the president, but that is not to say it's in the interests of the American people, the British people, or anyone else.
Tony Blair is not only prime minister, but he's the head of your party. What's happening here?
Well, it's an interesting question. Mind you, the relationship between Britain and America is a slightly wider question. Put crudely, America began as a British colony, and it's ended up with we're an American colony. And during the Cold War, there were about 120 American bases here. America used Britain as a sort of unsinkable aircraft carrier to bomb Libya and as a base during the Cold War period. With one or two exceptions, the Suez War is one. The refusal of the Labour government to send troops to Vietnam is another. With very few exceptions, the successive British governments of all parties have virtually towed the line laid down by a succession of American presidents. And the core of it is really what we call the special relationship that doesn't have a lot of meaning, except that the United States government lends us nuclear weapons and allows us to pretend that they are an independent British nuclear deterrent, which they are not. So any distancing of British from American policy might lead to the withdrawal of those weapons, which would be seen as a humiliation in the eyes of the British electorate and the tabloid readers.
Prime Minister Tony Blair said in the United States, "We've got to recognize, in the light of our experience with Saddam Hussein, that diplomacy simply won't work unless it's backed up by the threat of force, or indeed the use of force."
Well, there'd been no attempt by the British or the American governments to find a solution. For example, the French ministers in Baghdad, the Turkish foreign ministers in Baghdad, the Russian foreign minister Primakov has been in Baghdad, the Egyptians have made contact, the Arab League are in Baghdad, but nobody from Britain or the United States has gone. And quite candidly, I do not believe for one moment that either President Clinton or Mr. Blair want to see a solution, although it's not difficult to imagine what the solution might be. No, my recent understanding of broadcast made is that the purpose of the Prime Minister's visit, apart from shoring up President Clinton's personal position, is to, brainwash people into believing that force is necessary, because we're the task force of that size. You either use it or withdraw, and if you withdraw the task force, then it's a humiliation. If you use it, it's a war. And for that reason, I think there's virtually no prospect of war being averted, because the president and the prime minister want one.
What is the response of the British people?
Well, it's very interesting you should ask that. Certainly during the Gulf War, when Mrs. Thatcher was prime minister to begin with, and then John Major, there was a lot of feeling about the illegality of invading Kuwait. But now it's quite different. I've just done a 10-minute program on one of the most popular network shows and a popular channel, and the people phoned in, and for about a couple of hours they were phoning in, and overwhelmingly in support of the view that I put forward, which is that you should find a diplomatic solution. And I think the reason for it is partly people say, why should Britain always hang around American policy? President Clinton is not all that highly respected in Britain for one reason or another, partly because the suffering of the Iraqi people as a result of the Gulf War is quite phenomenal. I mean, the number of bombs dropped by the so-called coalition in 1990-91 was the equivalent of 7 Hiroshima bombs. 500,000 children or more have died because of the sanctions. The United Nations Children's Fund said that there are now 1 million children starving in Iraq. I believe there's still sewage in the streets of Basra because there was a bombing of the sewage plant 7 years ago, and bridges were bombed, and one woman I spoke to the other day attended a cesarean operation on a woman in Baghdad without an anaesthetic, and she said it was just absolutely horrific. And I think world opinion has begun to get round to that and understand that there has got to be an easement of the human conditions of the people there who are totally innocent, who loathe Saddam, most of them, because he's a brutal dictator, but would not be assisted in any way by bombing.
President Clinton has just released the budget that the administration is putting forward, the first balanced budget in 30 years. But part of that is an increase in military spending. Will another attack on Iraq also justify in Britain, as it does in the United States, an increase in military spending?
Well, we spend much too much on military expenditures. It is. I mean, since the end of the Cold War, it's not at all clear who our enemy is. But there are people in the Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, who need a foreign enemy to boost their arms sales. And so I've no doubt whatever there'll be pressure for that. Depends how long this particular bombing goes on. It may be a short, murderous bombing attack, which doesn't take too long, unless it spreads, as Yeltsin said it might yesterday, involving Israel, involving other countries, Islamic fundamentalism, and so on. But what another thing that people in Britain, I think, have taken on board is that where did Saddam get the chemical weapons? Well, he got them from America. Until 10 years ago, America was supplying anthrax to Iraq. Britain had a seminar in Winchester 10 years ago on chemical weapons, and the head of the Biological Warfare Department in Baghdad was present. Britain supplied arms right up to the invasion of Kuwait. And indeed, the American ambassador in Baghdad told Saddam, because he told me when I talked to him, I had 3 hours with him in 1990, he said, the American ambassador said, if you go into Kuwait, it'll just be treated in Washington as an Arab question. Also, one or two people have discovered recently that Britain used chemical weapons on Iraq in 1920. The Royal Air Force bombed Iraqi tribesmen at the time of the British Empire with chemical weapons. So the story is not the way it is presented by the media, although the media have been much more understanding, funnily enough, of criticism this time than they were at the time of the Gulf War, which I also opposed.
The first hostage to be taken by the Iraqis during the Persian Gulf War was a British airman. He has come out and said, and he was brutalized when he was held hostage, and he has said he is against military action against Iraq.
Yes, I saw that. I saw him on television here, and I think it was a very interesting thing to say. And that's what I meant when I said media opinion is not as uniformly in favor of a war as it was. You see, put quite simply, we should be thinking now about the answer to the problem. What is the diplomatic answer? And it's fairly straightforward. There are two conflicting interests to be reconciled. One is to see how Saddam can be made to respect the United Nations resolution, around which there's unanimity, to allow inspectors in without restraint into Iraq. And the other is the humanitarian imperative of seeing that we stop starvation and the brutality because of the sanctions. Now, I think if it was put as a proposal that the Iraqis would agree to the full inspection and in parallel with it all the sanctions be lifted, I think the situation would disappear tomorrow. But I don't think that would be acceptable to President Clinton or Mr. Blair, because I think they want the war.
We're talking to Labour parliamentarian Tony Benn. He is the longest-serving representative of Labour in the British Parliament. What about the soldiers that did serve during the Persian Gulf War from Britain? Are they suffering the same kind of syndrome, the what we call Persian Gulf War illness, that tens of thousands of U.S. veterans are suffering from the Persian Gulf War?
Oh, very much. We call it the Gulf War syndrome, but it's the same thing. And the Department of Defense in Britain have dragged their feet on this, because this is another thing you have to remember about war. It's a horrible thing, war. But these guys in uniform, or heroes when it's going on, end up standing in line for Social Security when they're wounded or ill afterwards, and nobody cares a damn about them. The same was true of the Vietnam War veterans, who were instruments of another disastrous policy. So it is true that that has happened here, and although they've made more friendly noises since the new Labour government was introduced, nothing has actually been done about it. And that is a very serious thing. Also, depleted uranium bullets were used in the Gulf War, which are radioactive, because I remember in the cabinet about 20 years ago, it was suggested that we adopted the uranium bullets, which I opposed, but the American government wanted us to, and I think they are now widely used by Western forces. So, and also, if you bomb the chemical plants, which is what some people are suggesting would be done, the suspected chemical plants, if there are biological warfare agents there, they'll come out and poison the Iraqi population, might even blow across frontiers. So it's a completely ill-judged enterprise. And I think the reason the Americans don't want the sanctions removed is because if Iraq could sell its oil, the price of oil would fall. And that is not really what the United States wants. So the more you look at it, it's a shabby, nasty deal in which the United States and Britain, not that it's militarily significant, are absolutely isolated. And I have a horrible feeling it could go wrong in a big way.
Is there an understanding in Britain, as there is in the United States now, that things are being kept hot in Iraq by the United States because of a hot sex scandal that's going on here at home in the White House?
Well, that's been said. No, I can't believe that the president would want a war just to divert attention from that. But it's a factor that people bring up, and you try to say, well, let's get back to the real question. And I'm much more concerned, truthfully, about the president's global policy than I am about what happens in his private apartments.
If you were the Prime Minister of Britain right now, meeting with President Clinton, what would you do about Iraq?
Well, I mentioned I went to see Saddam in 1990, just off my own bat. I wasn't a minister at the time, of course, and I had 3 hours with the man. He is a brutal dictator, don't make any mistake about it, and he's imposed terrible suffering on his own people. But Tariq Aziz was there. There were about 8 other ministers, and we had this long, long discussion. One purpose of my visit was to get all the British hostages released, the human shields, as they were called, and they were released. The other was to persuade him to get out of Kuwait, because I said, if you don't, the United States will destroy you. And he said to me, they will destroy me anyway, whether I get out or not. And that turned out to be true, though he left it too late to withdraw. But nobody really understands the sense of betrayal that Saddam feels about being let down by his American allies and friends. There were people until 10 years ago just saw Saddam as an American puppet. And then all of a sudden they let him down, bombed him, and now they're having another go. And he was very interesting to talk to, like many people you loathe, about the conflict with Kuwait and about the problems of the area, and also about the link between the Palestinians and the Israelis and their relationship to the UN, where, of course, the UN has taken no action at all. It did nothing about the invasion of the Lebanon, nothing about Turkey making incursions into northern Iraq, nothing about Turkey going into northern Cyprus. Talk about democracy, but no democracy in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. They talk about weapons of mass destruction. There are weapons of mass destruction in Israel. And when they talk about people at risk with chemical agents, I think of that woman in Texas who's just been tied to a bed and killed by what is a biological weapon used so apparently in the interests of the of justice. So it's never quite as clear as it's made out.
British parliamentarian Tony Benn speaking to us from his office in London outside the House of Commons. He is the longest-serving Labour Party member in the British Parliament. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After nearly 30 years of silence, a former Mexican president gave his first formal explanation Tuesday of a massacre of protesters, disputing official accounts that blamed the killings on student agitators. Former Mexican President Luis Echeverria discussed the 1968 killings in Mexico City's Tlatelolco Square with Congress members investigating the event that helped define a generation of Mexican intellectuals. Most observers say at least 300 people died after a mix of uniformed soldiers, police, and men in civilian clothing surrounded and opened fire on a peaceful pro-democracy demonstration. But officials have claimed only about 30 died in the event, just weeks before Mexico hosted the Olympics in 1968. Echeverria was an interior secretary in control of internal security and police forces at the time of the massacre. Some Mexican leaders, including former President Gustavo Díaz Ordaz, Echeverria's superior at the time, blamed the killings on students who fired machine guns from nearby buildings. But during his 2.5 hours of testimony on Tuesday, Echeverria disputed Díaz Ordaz's account. He said these kids were not provocateurs, maybe one or two, but the majority were the sons and daughters of workers, farmers, and unemployed people. In a 1978 magazine interview, Echeverria made comments in line with Ordaz's account. Until this past Tuesday, he hadn't talked about it again. Well, also on Tuesday, though just before I heard this news of the former Mexican president, I had the opportunity to speak with one of Mexico's leading journalists. Her name, Elena Poniatowska. She had just come to New York from Mexico City. I talked to her about a variety of issues, including her latest book on the communist photographer Tina Madati. But I started by talking to her about Massacre in Mexico. It's a book she wrote just after the Mexico City Massacre of 1968.
In 1968, when the students were massacred in Mexico City, which I think ties into today, what's going on in Chiapas, you wrote quite a remarkable book called Massacre in Mexico, a book that ultimately sold something like 250,000 copies in Mexico because it was so hard to get word out about what really happened, even the numbers of people who died. What did the government say, something like 20 people died?
Look, the government said 20, but really the Guardian in England, the newspaper said it was about 250 or 300 people.
And so you went out. Can you tell us the form that you wrote your story in and what you found when you went out onto the streets of Mexico City to talk about to those who survived the shootings?
I went out mainly to jail every Sunday. It was difficult to get into jail. And I talked to the students. And as I couldn't get anything out of jail, I couldn't go in with a tape recorder or anything. I reconstructed what they said at night in the house. And then they sent me messages with things they had written. So this is how I did it.
Let's back up for a minute. Tell us what actually did happen then. Because in this country, unfortunately, Mexican history is not really taught.
Well, as you know, you must know very well, there was in 1968, there were students' movements in nearly all over the world. They started, the first one started in Berkeley. And then afterwards, they moved to France. There was also Le Mouvement des étudiants du mois de mai en 1968. And there was only one student that was killed because of a mistake in Jussieu, because he thought the police was going to catch him. He ran and he fell. But he was the only one that was killed. And there were also students' movement in Czechoslovakia, in Praga, in Tokyo. Well, in many countries in the world. And in Mexico, there was a student movement because there was going to be the Olympic Games in 1968 in October. And the government got afraid. They were scared to death that the Olympic game, that the students would sabotage the Olympics. And besides, the students were asking the journalists. I remember the Italian Oriana Fallaci, who's a very well-known journalist who came from Italy. They were asking them to come and see what they were doing, to come to their meetings. So Oriana Fallaci, on October 2nd, she went to this meeting in Tlatelolco, and she was wounded by a bullet. And a student fell. He protected her. He grabbed her and he threw her on the floor and threw himself on top of her. And she wrote afterwards that she had been in Vietnam and she had been everywhere, and that she had seen killings, I mean bombings everywhere, and that she had never seen in any other country that people were being killed and shot at without the possibility of going into a refuge or escaping or being protected at the moment of the bombing. No, so it was a very awful and surprising thing that happened in my country, and
the students and the government responded in this way to the protests. Why? Why did the pre?
Because they want to cut this movement immediately. They wanted to cut it, to have it stopped before the Olympic Games, and they wanted to teach the students a lesson. And they did, because the movement completely finished in jail. Everyone, the leaders, were all put in jail. But it had a great moral support afterwards, and it's been very important for democracy now because of Chiapas, because of the new party, the PRD, because of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas. It has a lot of importance.
Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas being the current mayor of Mexico City, but who ran in 1988 for president, and it's believed the PRI stole the election from him. We're talking to Elena Poniatowska, one of the leading journalists in Mexico today. She's written many books, including Massacre in Mexico, about the massacre in 1968 of the students in Mexico City. And she's written a book called Tinissima, about the communist photographer Tino Modotti. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But you interviewed Subcomandante Marcos, one of the Zapatista leaders. He invited you to the jungle in Chiapas to speak with him. What did you think of him?
Oh, I loved Marcos. I loved Marcos because I think I've never seen such kind eyes. And besides, because he doesn't lie. What he says, he does. He was a professor at the university. Doesn't matter. He really is Subcomandante Marcos. He chose to be Subcomandante Marcos. But before that, he was Rafael Guillén Vicente. We have to recognize him as Subcomandante Marcos. But he was a university professor. He was a man who went into the jungle, who's been there for 15 years, living with the people, sharing the conditions of the people, having a very bad stomach because he's not used to the food, and being very brave and very courageous about everything, no? And standing up and standing next to those people. So for me, he is a hero. The Mexican government is not going to like me if I say those things.
He's been totally identified?
Well, no. For me, he's Subcomandante Marcos. He is.
But you said his name.
Yes, his name. Yes, but it doesn't matter what he has done in his life, which is important, is being is while he is Subcomandante Marcos and being Subcomandante Marcos, and this we have to respect. You know?
And what is the significance of the Zapatista uprising and the continued rebellion, and right through to now? I mean, in the last month, we've seen the massacre at Acteal. Where the fighting continues or the attacks on the Zapatistas continue. Mm-hmm. What does it mean for people, for example, where you live in Mexico City?
Well, it means that perhaps for the first time in our lives, we're thinking about the Indians. Now, we're always speaking about Indians, how to help them. There are 10 million Indians in my country. They were never taken into consideration. We were going in right into the NAFTA in 1990. That's why maybe the war started on January 1990, because
1994.
I'm sorry, because the free trade agreement was starting, and they were asking us. I guess they were asking, "What are you going to do with us? You're going to be modern. You're going to be into the first world. You're going right there, and what about us? What is going to happen with us? We don't know how to read and write. We die of curable sicknesses. We die of typhoidea, of tetanus, of all those sicknesses that no one dies of anymore. No." We don't have light, we don't have water, we don't have anything. No? So I think this was a reminder to the world and to Mexico of the existence of the indigenous people.
After you wrote your book, Massacre in Mexico, you were awarded a national prize for it, but it's a prize that you refused. The president was going to give it to you. Why did you refuse it?
Because I said, who's going to give a prize to the dead?
Who is the president?
Luis Echeverria. He's still in Mexico. He's still alive. Only he's more bald. He's more completely
so
bald.
He was with the PRI, but he was also in charge of, ultimately
yes.
In charge of the military at the time of the massacre, wasn't
yes.
he?
Yes.
So why did he want to give you a prize writing about
because
it?
Because they wanted to, if they took everything in, the government took everything in, then there would be no more guilt. No, they wouldn't be guilty anymore because everyone would be, well, in the government, no?
Was he insulted by your refusal?
I don't know. I didn't ask him. I've never seen him.
You also wrote about the earthquake. And you did it in a similar way that you wrote about Massacre in Mexico. You went out day after day, and you ended up, getting a letter published every day in La Jornada, Maine,
yes,
Mexican
an
paper.
Article every day. On the people who were speaking about what had happened to them in the earthquake, all the voices of the people, and then it came into a book. Yes,
the book you wrote was called Nada, Nadi, Nothing, Nobody. What so interested you in the earthquake, in this natural phenomenon?
Well, I was not really. I was in my house. I was going to continue writing my novel, and then. As I say, it's so difficult in Mexico because everything comes in and takes you out of your house. So it was very difficult to as a journalist, because I'm mainly a journalist, to stay. So I decided, first I decided to do what every citizen does, no? Is to take water, to bring food, to gather clothes and gather medicines and do everything with the brigade, no? And I went during nights and nights to get out the rubbles and things that we all do, no? But then afterwards, other journalists told me, no, Elena, stop doing that. You're not tall enough. You're not strong enough. Don't do all these things that others can do. You have to write. So I turned to the people, and they were very willing to speak, and I started interviewing them. But never with a micro like this. Always I took
microphone.
Notes. I took notes. And others came to my house to speak and to denounce. And then a center for people to come and speak about what had happened to them was created. And I went to that center and also spoke to the people.
It seems one of the things that were exposed was not only the earth and the cracks in the earth, that it was a natural phenomenon, that particularly poor people suffered because of the structure of buildings and what other things caused there to be even a disparity in the way people suffered during the earthquake.
It was always, it's always the poor people that suffer the most. No, they're always like the canon father of everything. No, they always it was not the rich whose houses were torn down. It was always in the center of the city, which is the poorest quarters, and some buildings, and of course all the government buildings that, and the hospitals that should never, never fall because of corruption, because they were badly built. That's why they fell into rubbles, and maternities, women that were giving birth, were found under the rubbles. And there was this story also about the boys, the little babies that were born and that survived even a month afterwards, and that were kept living because of the placenta and because they were used to the dark. Their mothers were dead, but they survived, and they were taken out of the rubble, yes. Hmm.
Leading Mexican journalist and author Elena Poniatowska is our guest. Let's move now to your latest book, Teenissima, which I had the pleasure over the last 2 weeks of reading. It's about Tina Modotti, who was an Italian refugee to the United States at the turn of the century. She gained attention as a Hollywood actress, then moved to Mexico after the revolution, became a photographer and a communist, and she was deported from Mexico, ultimately went to the Soviet Union, then fought in the Spanish Civil War, and came back to Mexico. Her life really chronicles a critical portion of the 20th century. Tell us about Tina Modotti.
Yes. Well, Tina Modotti, she was born in Udine, Italy, near Trieste, and she came because of poverty to the United States with her family. She belonged to a very big family. It was very big for American standards, not very big for Italian ones. And she arrived here and she started working as a seamstress when she was very young. And then she was an actress and she became a Hollywood star. And this is when she met Edward Weston. And Edward Weston is probably one of the greatest American photographers, next to Stieglitz and Ansel Adams, and he took her as an apprentice and as a student of his, and also as his lover, to Mexico. And she arrived in Mexico, and she was taken by Mexico. Mexico resembled Udine. The streets looked like Udine. The poverty, the meekness, the gentleness of the Mexicans. She was very taken. I think she fell in love with Mexico, and that's when I think her real important life started, because she always made fun with Edward Weston. She always made fun of her life in Hollywood. Once they went into a movie house and they saw a picture of her that was called, one of her pictures that was called The Tiger's Eye, and she comes out like a femme fatale, you know, she has a knife between her teeth and she's strangling her lover, some really corny thing like this. And she says that Weston and herself, they started laughing and laughing. They laughed so much they had to leave the movie. They were asked to leave the movie house and they had to leave. So I think afterwards she was ashamed. When she became a communist, she was completely ashamed of her Hollywood past.
So she was in Mexico. How did she go from working with Weston to becoming a photographer herself?
Because she worked with him. She was an apprentice. She took the pictures that he took mostly. She worked behind him. There are pictures that are, for instance, he took a circus tent. She took a circus tent also. But she always managed to put people in. He never put people. He always had the objects. And she always had the people barging in, their faces. And so I think he taught her everything she knew about photography. And it was because of him that she became a very great photographer. But she became a great photographer also on her own, because she started taking the things that he would never take, like, for instance, people in the streets, and the little girls that were abandoned and children in the streets, street children, and also very Mexican faces. And then as she worked for the communist newspaper El Machete, she was asked to take political events, and she did so. And she did it in a very original way, because she used to climb up on a ladder to get a multitude, or to get people, the hats, the revolutionary round Mexican hats that are so classical. She took them from the sky, and she did the pictures that Western never did.
And ultimately, she ended up being forced to leave Mexico, but not before she was involved in a major scandal, which started with the murder of her Cuban lover, someone she got involved with after Weston went back to the United States.
And we'll find out more about that and the rest of communist photographer Tina Modotti's life when we come back. Our guest, leading Mexican journalist and author Elena Poniatowska. Her latest book is called Tinísima. It's published by Penguin Books. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Mexican leading journalist Elena Poniatowska, her latest book is called Tinísima, about the communist and photographer Tina Modotti. Elena, we were just talking about the point in Tina Modotti's life where her Cuban lover is murdered in Mexico. It's right after Tina's friend Edward Weston had returned to the United States.
Yes. First, she had another lover, Javier Guerrero, and she became a communist because of Javier Guerrero. And it was in the Communist Party that she met Julio Antonio Mella, who was a beautiful young Cuban who was exiled in Mexico. They immediately fell in love. She heard him speak at a meeting for Sacco and Vanzetti. And
The Italian anarchist who ultimately got executed.
Yes, yes. Asking for their freedom, which of course they didn't get because they were executed, as you say. And then they lived together, but they barely, I think that's why the love was so profound. It was just like Romeo and Juliet. Maybe if it would have continued, it wouldn't have been the same, no? And they only lived together for 4 months. And after that, he was murdered in the streets while walking with her. Arm in arm, their arms were hooked. So she was immediately accused. They said it was a passionate murder. The newspapers in 5 days completely destroyed her reputation. She was torn apart. Pictures, photographs of her taken by Edward Weston, of her lying naked in the roof, beautiful photographs, were printed to show that she was a corrupt, vicious Italian. And Diego Rivera and Miguel Covarrubias, the two Mexican painters, had to defend her and said that this was art. These were artistic photographs. But still, her reputation was torn, they really put her down, no? They really destroyed her. And after that, she continued in Mexico. She never killed really Julio Antonio Mella. Mella was killed They say either by the communists because he was becoming a Trotskyist, but this hasn't been proved, but he was really killed by people sent from Cuba to kill him, no? To murder him, a dictator called Machado. And after that, she stayed in Mexico only for 1 year. She was asked to become an official photographer for a museum, and she said that she would never be she would never have a post in a government that was incapable of finding Maya's murderer, and that's why she was accused afterwards of having participated in the murder, which isn't true. He wasn't murdered either. He only had a scratch on one of his cheeks. Of a stupid Mexican president called Pascual Ortiz Rubio. I'm saying stupid because he did only stupid things. No? And nothing happened to the president. He wasn't killed, but Tina was expelled from Mexico with other communists, Mexican and Latin American and European, and she was sent on a Dutch boat to Germany. She chose to go to the. She did. She was the one who chose. She chose Germany.
She couldn't go back to Italy because she thought she'd be thrown in jail right away under Mussolini.
Yes.
She then went on to the Soviet Union, and it was a time when communists all over the world were very excited about what was going on in the Soviet Union, and she ended up becoming a spy for the Soviets.
Yes. I don't know if she was a spy. They say she was an agent, no? But she took passports to people who needed passports. She did it very well. She knew many languages. She
in spoke Germany.
And she spoke German, of course, because many Italians in Trieste and in Udine, they all go over to Austria for work, so they learn German. She spoke German. She spoke English. She spoke French. And she spoke beautiful Spanish and, of course, Italian. And she was a very simple person. In a way, she was very short, first of all, which is very, it's a great advantage in life to be very short. And she always wore a very plain white blouse, and she had little buckle shoes with no high heels, and she had a little black skirt. And no one really noticed her, but still they, especially at the end of her life and at this part of her life, and she didn't want to be noticed. So I think she made a wonderful agent. And then she worked in Russia for the International Red Aid that helped all the political opponents of all countries that went to Russia as if they were going to heaven, no?
And she ended up going to fight in the Spanish Civil War.
After Russia, Vittorio Vidali, her last lover, was sent to Spain in 1936, and she went with him. And there she became a nurse. She was called Maria Sanchez, and she started working with a Canadian doctor, Norman Bethune, who was a wonderful man. She started working in the trenches, doing transfusions to the soldiers that usually died on the way to the hospital. But she and him, they between under the bombs and everything, they did all these transfusions to the soldiers, and they could save many lives. And she had great courage. And she also worked at the same time in the kitchens and then afterwards at the International Red Aid again.
She was remarkably brave. She had also given up her photography.
She gave up her photography. No one understands very much why, because it's difficult to believe that someone who loves something so much as she loved photography suddenly throws it away. Pablo Neruda wrote a poem saying that she had thrown her camera into her Graflex, a big camera, she had thrown it into the Neva River. But what happened is that when she reached Germany, because she wanted to go to Germany because the magazine ANZ had published photographs of her. So in Germany, she found that there were so many cameras, so many photographers, so much photojournalism, people walking in the streets and taking 12 photographs in 2 minutes. And she was horrified because she was such a slow photographer. It took her such time. She never took pictures in Germany. She took about 4 pictures, which aren't her best pictures, of course. And then she got very disappointed. She stopped corresponding with Edward Weston in the States, and then she became a complete communist. She renounced to herself. She said to herself, "I'm not Tina Modotti anymore. I'm just a person at the service of a revolution I have to believe in. Oh, I believe in. I'm sorry."
And ultimately, it was a revolution in Spain that proved unsuccessful. They lost that war. Uh-huh. And you write quite painfully about what that meant and all of the volunteers from all over the world, including many Spanish Civil War volunteers from the United States going back. And she went. She left and ultimately went back to Mexico.
Yes, because she wanted to go to the United States, really, because she thought she could do a better work in the United States than in Mexico. And besides, she had been expelled from Mexico. So she was very much afraid to go back to Mexico. But still, she had to. And in Mexico, I think it's the saddest years of her life, the last years of her life, because first of all, Vittorio, who greeted her, who met her in Mexico, was always like all Italians. Well, I don't know if all of them, but they are very flirtatious, no? They are very operisticos, no? They're always making big gestures and making love to brooms or to women, whatever they can find, no? And Vittorio was like that. He loved women. He was a womanizer, the way you say it. And he said that he had to take cold showers during the war because he loved women so much, and the party forbade him to go chasing a woman instead of doing his work. So he had to take showers all the time, showers of cold water.
A very clean man.
A very clean man, yes. So Tina, I think, had a very difficult life, and then she realized that she was getting old. She already had white hair. She grew older. She was older before she should have been older, because she died at 46, and they said she looked really like a very old woman. Not her body. Her body was still beautiful, but her face. No, she had white hair, and she looked sick.
Well, this description of this woman, this young woman, this photographer, artist, very political woman who came from Italy and lived in Mexico, we can't help but notice some parallels, was short, only of stature. But with your life, in fact, you were interested in photography, weren't you?
I'm not a photographer, no. I started when all journalists in Mexico, young journalists, are taught photography. So at the beginning, I took many photographs in the streets. But then I stopped because I broke my camera like a stupid ass I am. I broke it. So I couldn't continue. I didn't continue. But I love photography, I certainly do, and I love working with photographers. I've worked with other photographers like Manuel Alvarez Bravo, who's now about 202 years old. He's 94. He's very old, but he was Tina's disciple, and I think he was a little bit in love with Tina. He's another one who loves women. And Lola Alvarez Bravo also. And then I worked with Mariana Jampolsky, who's a lovely, extraordinary photographer. And with Graciela Iturbide, we did a book together called Juchitán, on the women of Juchitán, the women in Oaxaca, women that look a little bit like Ana Castillo, only they're fat. They're fat. They don't have her figure.
Well, she can just work on it for a couple of years.
She has to drink a lot of beer. They drank a lot of beer. It's true, you know, they got fat because they drank a lot of beer. Before, they used to drink pulque. That was a national, it's not delicious, but they say it's very good for the health. They give babies pulque, and they were very thin. They have lovely figures. If you see Tina Modotti's pictures of Juchitán, you see these beautiful women. And now they're like towers, you know. They walk like this in the street, and they can hide all their lovers under their skirts or something like that, because they are really immense women and very powerful.
We're talking to Elena Poniatowska, and among other books, she has written a novel called Tinissima. It is about Tina Modotti, who is a artist and communist, eventually came back to Mexico and died there at the age of 46. What fascinated you most about Tina Modotti?
I wasn't fascinated at all by Tina Modotti. I was scandalized and shocked at the beginning because I come from a Catholic school where you're told that the first thing that a good little girl should do is to put on her panties in the morning or never take them out. I don't know, never pull them up. So I was horrified when I heard about her. When I heard about Tina, when I saw the photographs, I looked at them, I was really shocked. But then I was asked to do a movie script about Tina Modotti. That's how it started. And of course, in Mexico, they say, you have to do this movie script for the day after tomorrow. No, we give you 2 days. But then it's called the Cineteca Nacional, where you keep all the movies, all the films.
The archives.
The archives burnt down, so there wasn't any money to do the film. And I had interviewed all these old communists, women and men, and I was very, very moved by them, very touched, all the Mexicans. And then I had gone to Trieste to see Tina Modotti's last lover, Vittorio Vidali. I stayed with him for a week.
Well, after Tina Modotti died, several different communist groups named themselves after her. Is that right, in Mexico?
Yes, communist groups, and then people who had their working machines, not in factories. They had some machines called after her, and she was really an emblem. But then she was absolutely forgotten, like most women.
Elena Poniatowska has been our guest. She is a leading Mexican author and journalist. Her latest book, Tinissima, about the communist photographer Tina Modotti. It's published by Penguin Books. Among her other books, Massacre in Mexico, Dear Diego, and Nobody, Nothing about the Mexican earthquake. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hsu Ku. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Oh, and by the way, happy birthday, Bob Marley. He would have been 53 years old today.